What's really going on in the heads and hearts of the humans around you? I'm Mads Grummet, journalist, entrepreneur and startup investor.
And I'm Sabina Reid, psychologist, speaker and media commentator. And this is Human Cogs, a podcast about the universal experiences that really matter and the candid conversations we need to have to share them.
If you like Human Cogs, we'd love you to hit subscribe and please leave us a star rating.
That way we can keep bringing you more stories from extraordinary ordinaries to help us all do human well.
If you've turned on the radio lately, have you ever sat back to listen to who's telling the stories? Current data shows that only 27% of radio hosts are women. Female experts are quoted just 34% of the time. And here's the clanger, 90% of radio voices of people aged over 45 are in fact men. Yep, 90%.
So why is that? What is going on? And how does this skew attitudes and perpetuate gendered inequality in society?
Well, good questions. And our guest today is Jo Stanley. And she's been asking herself those questions for years and is now on a mission to change the stats with the launch of Broad Radio, Australia's first women-centric radio network, connecting women through audio and serving the mostly overlooked 5 million strong female audience aged over 35.
Of course, Jo Stanley is no stranger to audio, with a decades-long successful career in breakfast radio, including rating number one for 6 years on Melbourne's Fox FM and dominating the top spot at Gold FM, alongside her ongoing TV, writing and podcast gigs.
Now, Jo's obviously been in the public spotlight and shared her life with millions of listeners every day. But in this chat on Human Cogs, Jo shares how the lack of levity in her childhood shaped her, the challenges of living with fear behind the scenes, and how the birth of her daughter taught her what being enough really means.
Here's our chat with the warm, funny, and insightful Jo.
Well, Jo Stanley, thank you for joining us on Human Cogs today for
I'm stoked.
A little yak over a cup of tea. So there are so many things we can talk about with you, but let's start with comedy because you cut your teeth as a comic way back, reportedly in a dingy room where you were discovered back in the early 2000s.
I know, what a great story.
Well, yeah. Tell us the joke. Don't people say that to comedians? But actually, what led you to stand up? What led you to be in that dingy room?
Well, I studied drama at university and I guess had stars in my eyes and thought I would be an actor and wasn't particularly good. I don't think I'm a very good actor, to be honest. And so at the time, I went to Monash University where it was a culture of lots of comedy reviews and, you know, my first boyfriend was in the comedy reviews and he was a stand-up and so I kind of was led down that path of writing. And I've always, like, I remember being at high school and being the house drama captain and writing jokes as a part of the play we wrote and having that moment of hearing the audience laughing and going, oh, I like that. I see why that joke worked. It was an innate thing for me. So when I was, you know, at uni and doing the comedy reviews, it just felt really natural to explore performance that way rather than keep banging on doors of casting agents where it was clear that I was not tall and blonde and it was clear that I was maybe not that great an actor either. Or I wasn't willing to put myself through the ringer of learning how to be a better actor. I think maybe I was a bit lazy.
A serious thespian.
I was scared and lazy.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. I mean, lazy is one of my pet peeves, that word. I think I wish there wasn't the word lazy in the English language because, and you've already just followed it up by saying actually scared, because lazy infers you're not doing something because you can't be stuffed. But usually when we don't do something, it's fear-based.
It's avoidance, right?
But why do we avoid? Because we're fearful of what will come, or we don't think it will be good enough, or we'll be rejected, or someone will judge us. So we excuse under the guise of lazy. But what were you fearful of?
I guess it's, you know, learning to be a really good actor requires a great deal of self-reflection and a great deal of self-exploration and being extremely vulnerable, which I guess I wasn't mature enough to do at that time. Now I think I'd be fine with it. And in fact, you know, my writing and comedy sort of went down that path. But at the time, I just didn't know how to do it. I'd spent at high school, I was in the drama sort of crew, but didn't have great experiences of it, in that I was not in the cool group. It felt really hard to break into that world with my own lack of confidence and all the voices in your head that you have as a teenager, I suppose. And my mum was not, it was not an environment in our family where you could sort of feel like risks. We just were not a risk-taking family, you know. So I don't know, it just wasn't really encouraged in me to be that person.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how to be a different version of me at that time. So the easiest option was to go to pubs and you know, in the 90s in Melbourne, it was lots of open mic rooms, loads, tryouts, and go and just sort of cut your teeth doing that stuff. And so I did that with the troupe. We were like a sketch comedy group, and then ended up working with another woman, Jodie J. Hill. And she and I sort of worked together for a while and ended up on radio together.
And what was the role of humour in your family growing up, either for you or others? How did humour represent itself in your family?
Well, so my father died when I was 4, and that was, from that moment, there was not a lot of levity in our house, I suppose, and a great deal of sadness, mm-hmm. always.
Mm.
It's just kind of present, always, and fear. So, but that wasn't to say we didn't laugh. Like, we did a lot. And my grandmother particularly, my dad's mother, taught me storytelling. She was just an extraordinary storyteller, always hilarious, always with the perfect structure, beginning, middle, end. Like, she just knew. It's probably where I kind of learned it. And Sunday afternoons, it was always with my other grandmother, my Nana, sitting on the couch watching Lucille Ball, or, you know, Get Smart, or those sorts of shows that were always on reruns in the 80s, Sunday
good,
afternoon.
Good hammy kind of comedy,
oh,
that stuff.
Yes, you know, just really hammy, but I don't know, there was always an authenticity to it. There was an honesty, particularly Lucille Ball, don't you reckon? She was just she was vulnerable. Like, she was able to courageously sort of portray this housewife that seemed to have a perfect life, but also she always seemed to be wanting more, which I think a lot of housewives feel. So yeah, laughter was always there, but it was a choice to laugh. You know, you had to. It wasn't necessarily always natural.
Mm. And a lot of people would say that comedians are drawn to humour to counterbalance some darkness or wounds of their own. Do you think there's a logic or a sense? Have you observed that in yourself or other comedians?
I mean, there are a lot of fucked up comics.
Yes. But there's a lot of fucked up people.
That's right.
Like, fuckers are funny.
Sure. If you can't laugh at yourself, what are you going to do? I can't speak to whether there are more fuck-ups in comedy than other industries is what I'm saying. I don't know. But there are, sure, there's heaps. And I think, yeah, you have a natural inclination to laugh at yourself, hopefully, and the shit parts of life as a way of getting through. It's better that than other methods of coping, which, honestly, that's in comedy as well. All the different methods, well, whatever.
It's the best,
you know,
best medicine, or but, however the cliches go.
Yeah, but for me, I guess I was drawn to it as a writing and performance, not as some kind of, oh, you know, I need to.
It wasn't self-therapy so much.
No.
I mean, you were also chasing a boy. You said you were with the boyfriend who was in comedy, so it was kind of the world that you were in at the time.
That was an entree to it, and we, you know, we broke up and, you know, I stayed and, yeah, it was, obviously I wouldn't be here without it. Wouldn't literally be sitting in this chair without it. So what a great gift it was.
Yeah. You went beyond the pubs and comedy into radio, and, of course, many people will know you from the Matt and Joe show, which was a juggernaut back in the early 2000s. How did you come to get that gig? What was the leap? I'm sure there were many sort of
well, yeah,
lily pads.
Quite literally, it was doing a show in at the Prince Pat in Collingwood with Jodie J. Hill. And the head of programming came and saw that show and invited us to have a meeting with him. And I remember the meeting because my grandfather had died and I was going on to the funeral from that meeting. And it was kind of a weird out-of-body experience, you know, when you kind of, I'm supposed to go and impress this dude. I don't even know what someone like that is looking for to give them a show. And now I'm going to go and, you know, farewell my dear old grandfather. And anyway, so had the meeting. I remember at one point we said maybe vulva or some word that felt completely normal to us that made him reel back.
the V word.
I don't remember what it was. It's something related to genitals of the female nature.
I think vulva sometimes shocks more than vagina, and I don't know why that is.
I think because they don't know what it is.
It's got two V's in it as well.
Double the V.
It's like double V.
But I think also maybe they don't know what the vulva, they're like, vulva has something, it's downstairs. But what part is that exactly? So, yeah, and then so he gave us a Sunday night development show, which we did every Sunday for like a year or maybe two. I can't remember. I just remember there was a time at which Jodie and I went, that is it. It is enough of Sunday. For fuck's sake, give us a show or just let us go because it's too much. And so then they gave us Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to midday on Fox FM. Which
is huge. Like you're saying, right? Fuck off Sunday night. But, and we demand daytime.
Wow. Well, yeah, because most...
Vulva, vulva, vulva.
I felt really bad because I still feel bad because often people, young people, will ask my advice as far as how to break into radio and most people go to the regionals and have to do their time in Horsham or wherever.
You didn't even want to do Sundays.
Straight into Capital City on Fox FM. And at the time it was did not pass us by that was... big, you know, and a great opportunity. So Jode and I did that for 2 years and then I ended up on the Matt and Joe show.
Mm.
Yeah.
And of course, you spent, 10 years or so, a lot of years.
10 years
at
doing that,
the cold face of breakfast
with
radio.
With Maddie, yeah. And then went on to Gold as well with Limo.
Yeah, and I, full disclosure, have done some breakfast with ABC and they are very early starts and you want to smash the alarm clock in. I mean... what's that like, that life, that relentless sort of spin of breakfast radio?
Well, I mean, it's the best job in the world, right? So it's brutal, but you can't say it's hard. Like it is hard, but you're not digging ditches. Like you're not.
No, of course.
You know what I mean? Like, you're constantly jet lagged. You're constantly on the edge of a hysterical meltdown because you're so completely depleted.
Exactly, because you're keeping possum hours with that and even energy levels, like what it must do to disrupt your natural energy state in your body, it would take its toll.
So not only are you sleep deprived, but it's the mental game of being forward facing. You know, that was a bit of an easier time because people didn't get cancelled quite so easily and we didn't have as much social media. Like I remember... Twitter started when I was doing that show. So we predated Twitter. I think Facebook was around when we started. I mean, it was definitely big for us, but just the social media hadn't taken off in the same way. So we weren't as at risk, but you still got that kind of heightened sense of making sure that every single word you say is right. Not to suggest I was paranoid or anything, and you're really in the moment. You're in a very safe team, which is helpful, and your connection with the audience and your authenticity to what you're saying, I believe, kind of protects you from saying the wrong thing. But, you're forward-facing the whole time. You're always aware that you could get sacked at any moment, and, you know, you do get sacked. It's all of that. It's feeling like, oh, what if people don't like me? I mean, you know, you have all those – it's not just imposter syndrome, but you are really – if you're someone like most women, I think, you're a people pleaser and you're like, ugh, what if people really start to not like me or my jokes are shit or whatever? So there's that. And
coming up with new content.
Yeah,
the
relentless need for material. I mean, you lower your standards very quickly.
Yes.
Say that because you get to a point where you're like, oh my god, it's April, I've run out of there's nothing more for me to talk about now, I'm tired, and you're like, sure, I'll talk about, you know, the dog in the
vulvas.
Park. Yeah, vulvas. Well, Jodie and I did get, I remember at one point, got soundly told off for using the word clitoris. And we were just like, oh, I'm so baffled by why I can't say that. I just can't. It's not computing for me. And
did
no,
they pull the data on how many penises had gone to air?
Well, you know, I was young and so scared all the time that I wasn't in a place to point that out to them in quite that way. I probably sort of intimated it. If it was me now, I most definitely would make that point very clearly. But, you know, I was young and scared.
There's a real formula in breakfast radio where there's typically a male and a female co-host.
Typically female and two men usually.
Okay, two, yeah. even more. So why is that?
It's just the way they've always done it. They don't know why.
Do you know why?
It's because the industry is run by men mostly. It's shifting slowly, but it's still very largely run by men. For a long time, and they probably still do, I don't know, I've been out of commercial radio for 6 years now, so maybe they don't still do this, but they used to often use market research around the fact that they don't like hearing two women together. The audience, don't like hearing two female voices together. And when I...
We're fucked.
Yeah.
Three of us on
yeah.
this.
Well, I mean, you know, the entire podcasting industry, I think, is disproving that on the hourly.
Yes.
And, you know, I used to say towards the end when I sort of had started to find my voice and understanding of who I was and not be quite so scared of those people, I used to say, well, you know, market research doesn't happen in a bubble. So the people you're asking are already subject to gender bias. Yes. And particularly the audience you're asking, which were, you know, people born like in the 70s, went through their formative years in the 80s, they grew up watching Harvey Weinstein films. So our understanding of women's role in entertainment and media is as the laugh track, as the chick in the bikinis, as the hilarious old lady who's actually only 35. You know, let's put this in context. Who are you asking and how are you asking them? And have they ever heard two women together? Jodie and I were I believe we're one of the only shows to be two women together in a prime time, you know, capital city market.
Jane Hall and Chrissy Swan come to mind. And Chrissy then did, I think, sort of drive, or 3 p.m. pickup it was back in the day with Yumi Stein.
Yeah, so this is my point. I would say we can name the teams that have been more than one woman together. We can actually name them. That's how rare they've been.
Yeah.
Whereas if we said about naming all the men that have been duos, you couldn't do it. There's so many, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. But actually we could sit down and easily name the ones that have been.
So this bias that you talk about, and we know that's implicit in so many businesses and business models, and if you've got mainly men mainly making the main decisions about what the business will do, then that's unfortunately a compounded byproduct of that. You've been in radio. I mean, watch, the rise of social media, the impact of that, you know, multi-platforming. We've got a really complex and fragmenting media environment at the moment. And even commercial stations are really struggling to work out where their listeners are and what their listening habits are as we look at sort of move to on-demand and streaming. In all of this, you have made this incredibly bold, audacious and brilliant step, which is to launch your own radio network called Broad Radio for Women. Do you want me to do your promos?
It's great.
And so we know a lot about it, but we'd love for our listeners to hear, why did you start Broad Radio and where are you taking it?
Well, the why is I was looking for something to listen to, really, because I'd left doing breakfast radio and was like, awesome, I'm looking forward to being a listener now. And was doing guest spots and filling in Triple M. Love Triple M. Love their male audience that feels really safe there. And, you know, they talk about really important things that are great for that audience, important for that audience. And I was like, oh, you know, this is what I want for me as a woman over 35. Couldn't find it. And then just started you know, looking around and thinking, oh, that's a really strange gap in the market given women control the spending. So the business case sort of started to really emerge and became really clear to me that, well, if we had a platform, no doubt the brands would really love the fact that 97% of our audience are women over 35. Like, it's really cost efficient to use us because you're getting directly to those people. And then there was a moment too where I was lucky enough to be on the advisory council, the gender equality, oh my gosh, the Ministerial Council for Gender Equality on advising to the Minister for Women.
It is a long title.
It's very hard for me to remember sometimes. It was, you know, just basically a room full of incredibly fierce, brilliant women who would gather and just talk about government policy and how to make it more gender equal and how it could actually redress gender inequality in Victoria. And I guess it was one of the first times I've sat in a room where the diversity was just incredible, right? I'd come from the media as a very white space, right? I'm a very privileged cisgender white middle-class woman. And so I was sort of, I guess I was sitting in this room looking around and just going, these voices are never heard. You know, you might have 1 hour on a community radio show on a Saturday and, you know, community radio is amazing. They actually do better, they do so much for radio and our industry as a whole because they elevate those voices in ways that mainstream media don't.
And a really great pipeline for up-and-coming
amazing
presenters.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah, I just sort of looked around and went, oh, God, that's now become really a thing I can't get out of my head, that this has to exist. And so I did speak to Southern Cross Austereo. This is pre-COVID. And they were pretty interested. Like, we talked for a bit, but then COVID hit. And over the course of that time, I just thought, I feel like I want to do it in a way that is really what I know is what an audience wants. And whilst, you know, knocking on the doors at the big guys could have led me down a different path and maybe a more successful path, I don't know, I don't think I would have been able to do it in the way that I'm doing now and the way that I want to do it, which is to really centre the voices of diverse women.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard. You know, coulda, woulda, who knows? You can't have those.
Yeah, not helpful those to
questions.
Look back.
No, but I don't regret it. You can't answer those questions, right?
Yeah.
You'll never know.
You just said I wanted to deliver what I knew the audience wanted. Mm. What do you think it is? What does the audience want?
I think women want to feel like their life experiences are valid. And I think the older you get, the less you have that said to you, right? The older you get, you don't see yourself in TV or movies. You might see, you know, Jodie Foster and Annette Bening in one movie every now and then. You've got beautiful Reese Witherspoon making incredible films.
Hello Sunshine are doing an amazing job, and Sarah Harden of creating
incredible
content for women and
incredible
elevating those stories of motherhood, of menopause, of this unique female lens on the world, which is varied. Some people doing it, but certainly radio. I mean, I think one of the stats that you had in your pitch pack was that over the age of 45, 90% of radio voices are men.
Yeah.
And even you also had in the same material, women are quoted as experts only 34% of the time.
Mm. Yeah.
Because the go-tos are the professors in universities and whatever, so...
Yeah, and when we are quoted, it's not finance and it's not, you know, politics, it's entertainment.
Or it's a case study.
Or health.
Mm. Yeah. Or well-being.
Yeah. So... for me, it's not just about that, though. It's not just about redressing that imbalance in the media. And you know, the fact is when you don't have those voices and you're not – you think about a teenage girl who never, ever hears a woman talk about politics, she's not going to think she can go into politics, right? It's that kind of impact on society. But really, I just want women to feel like their experiences are valid. Let's create radio that they can interact with immediately if they wish. You know, that's that, and there's definitely on demand and podcasts are part of broad radio. But radio itself is around that immediate interaction and really women hearing like uplifting, smart, inspirational, informative conversation that reflects their lives.
Do you think the live element is important there? Because there are a lot of podcasts, I think, that probably speak to that tone. Hopefully we do.
Yeah, of course. There's lots and lots, thousands and thousands. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So is Broad Radio also, you know, is the core foundation of Broad Radio is the live element you talked about? Yeah. There's something about the exchange in real time.
Well, firstly, it's about reflecting that moment, that city, that audience in that very moment, which daily podcasts do, absolutely. I mean, I would argue that daily podcasts are kind of a hybrid of radio and podcast anyway.
Mm, definitely.
You know, they bring that.
And they're very news-based.
Very news-based. Mm. So for me, radio is about that element of immediacy and that moment reflecting that city. And if we are wanting to actually shape that city, which media does, shape that society, which media does, you know, it needs to be, for me, and I'm not, like, podcasts are key to it, like it's you know, they sit side by side, but the live element provides that opportunity to do it in very real time, relating to what's going on at that time.
Mm-hmm.
What about Joe? Again, this is no secret, but obviously ABC and others are struggling with the shift away from linear, you know, from live and linear listenership as we move more to curated and on-demand audience preferences. What are your thoughts about that, you know, and what that shift looks like, and how can you meet people for listening moments where they're at in a live moment?
Well, I mean, that, as I say, the app is providing on, you can listen on demand whenever you wish, as well as listening live. You know, kind of what we're creating is more of a hybrid than if you were to have like a radio on a building site that you're listening to, you know, radio as we always have in the past. Commercial radio, though, it's still, you know, the numbers are amazing, and it's not, it's 79% of Australians are still listening to that radio. It's just that it's being delivered in different ways, and they have definitely explored and they continue to really invest in technology that is delivering it in different ways. So it's about the technology and how you actually take it to the people as they wish to hear it. I think it's a new and exciting time for audio, where we're exploring different ways of getting content and interaction with people. I believe that people will always want to interact with radio, with audio, let's say audio, right? And that's why, you know, live podcasts just go nuts. People want to go and meet their favourite hosts. Have you done a live one?
No, we have not. But like a live show, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, like the Imperfects do that.
And, no, lots of people do them, and they're incredible. Like Guilty Feminist ones are amazing, and, you know, like it's a real opportunity for that interaction. I think people hunger for it.
Mm, and I suppose that's also the shift now we see around this two-way dialogue. It's not just one mono voice out into the ether. Social media has enabled this two-way dialogue, but also, yeah, there's just much more interactivity, so that the audience is hopefully stickier because they feel like they are engaged with the people who are leading it.
But radio has always been a two-way dialogue.
Yes.
Well, always. We talk with talkback and all that, but even now it's fascinating. Yeah, we're seeing, you know, people come out into live events, and so this is very much, it's a really dynamic way for people to engage with host.
Mm.
One of the things I'd love to understand is a lot of the data that we're seeing now, you know, post-pandemic, in the middle of conflict and wars, that where the world's at, the broader dystopia that we're all living through, mm-hmm. and then this attrition of mainly women away from news-based content. When you think about the content mix on Broad, how will you shape that, and how are you thinking about the kind of content and stories that you want to sit in there? Will it be news-based?
No, we're not a news service.
Right. So what's some examples of the kind of shows and content?
And people that you've got on board as well, because you've got some fabulous names and extraordinary women who you're walking alongside.
Yes, we've had incredible support, and we're talking with some amazing women. Subject to availability, we'll be, you know, as a part of the show. So Judith Lucy has been very supportive and really excited about the idea, and Nellie Thomas is with us, Shelley Ware from the beginning. You know, we did a 2-year live stream MVP and had some incredible hosts on that show, some of which have gone on to become members of parliament. So Zoe Daniel, no longer available. But
doing good things in the
incredible things. Yes, so great women alongside us there on air as well as off air. And as far as the content is concerned, you know, quite deliberately, it's Broad. So the model is a very specific audience, but broad conversation can go absolutely anywhere. So I envision, and we won't roll out a 24/7 schedule right from the beginning. We need to grow deliberately and responsibly according to, you know, budgets available to us, of course. The end game is for there to be a morning show that you would listen, talk back, music, and have that great interaction about anything that women want to listen to that is actually relevant and of interest and, you know, fun for women to listen to. And then in and around that, you know, the drive, and then the drive show, and then there's special interest shows that could be anything from music to politics to health to relationships to literature to gardening. I mean, anything, right? Like whatever. And I guess it's not the first time I've been asked that question, and often I sort of think, oh, what a strange question to ask. Isn't it obvious? And then I realised that because I've been 15 years doing breakfast radio, it's quite innate to me that every single decision you make around what you put on air is about the filter of your audience. So it's really, we just make the conversation that our audience finds useful and uplifting and stimulating and something that they want to be a part of. It's that simple. So I guess it's, what would you talk about with your girlfriends?
Yeah. Is it across the lifespan age-wise, or is it like, so between Mads and I, we have 6 daughters and you have 1, so that makes 7 in the room. Is it younger women as well? What's the demographic?
We're specifically aiming for 35 plus because that younger demographic is looked after by commercial radio. Yeah, specifically 35 plus and very much into 50s, 60s, 70s and beyond as well. I believe, always have believed, that great conversation is great conversation, right? It's like great music is great music. It doesn't really matter what genre, it's good music, you know, I think it's good to listen to, and conversation as well. I think once you hit your sort of late 30s into your 40s, the conversation that you're interested in is a little deeper. That's why podcasts are so popular with women that age. You want something that's a bit deeper, that has some real heart to it. And I think that that's the case when you get, it doesn't matter how old you are, really. So, yeah, there's quite a broad age group, but deliberately so.
Mm. Has anyone said to you, I'm going to speak for not us, but, is there a station that's just for men?
Yeah, I have heard that quite a bit. Yeah,
I bet you might have heard that question.
It's every station, isn't it?
Well, there's Triple M, there's SEN, arguably AW as well, although they have a lot of women that listen to AW. But Triple M specifically comes to mind, yes. Yeah,
it stands for men, 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 doesn't it?
I don't know about that.
So broad radio could be Triple V.
But then it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because then radio for women, sort of by women, is there a place for blokes in there too?
Absolutely. We've had men on the MVP and we intend to have men. I mean, it's about centering the audience, right? So it's about centering an audience that are currently not hearing what they, you know, there's nothing that actually relates to their stage of life in radio. So it's centering the audience and elevating voices that are currently absent and having conversations about everything under the sun, but in a way that is relevant to that female audience. So again, I have always loved and would continue to love, if I was asked back, doing Triple M, but I'm a woman, right? But I know, because that's my job, what am I talking about today that is relevant to that male audience? That's my job, right? I could come in and talk about, you know, things that are really interesting to me, but that audience aren't going to give a shit. So I have to talk about, okay, put myself in their shoes. You know, radio is... That is literally your job. What does my audience want to hear today? That's your only job, really. So there's no reason why a man couldn't come on. And my husband would love to come on. He would be quite funny, actually.
He's very involved, isn't he?
Well, we're co-founders, so yeah.
But he's done nothing on air.
Oh, no, he's very shy.
And you call yourself an introverted show pony. What does that mean?
I am very naturally shy, but I guess I make a living being a performer. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean, I suppose.
Being a pony.
A show pony. And Joe, you work. We've had a lot of conversation here about audio and radio, but you work in other mediums too. You do a regular column in Sunday Life magazine, and regular on The Project.
No, not really.
Have been
in the past, not right now.
Okay.
I do the House of Wellness
though. And the House of Wellness. And you also do some things that feel very aligned to your values and interests. Like you're an ambassador for Smiling Mind.
Yes, yeah. So Smiling Mind, although, you know, they have a suite of ambassadors, so I always feel a bit like, am I really? Have I jumped on board a bandwagon there and they're going to be going, it's been a while since we worked together. But they never sent me a breakup letter, so let's just say that.
It sounds like you're still dating. Yeah.
Yeah, Smiling Mind, I'm a huge advocate for mindfulness and meditation. And, yeah, I have a bunch of other organisations that I feel really blessed to work with who are in the not-for-profit world.
And what's your hope? What's your hope with all of these different organisations and causes that you've aligned yourself with to continue to magnify what voice with what impact?
Well, they all are in the women's space or in disadvantaged kids, pretty much. So Wellsprings for Women, which is a beautiful community group in the city of Casey for refugee and asylum seeking women. Left Right Hook, which is an extraordinary – you should speak to Donna. Have you spoken to Donna?
No.
Oh, the founder of Left Right Hook. She's amazing.
What do they do?
That is a program for adult survivors, female and non-binary adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And they get together and they journal and then they box.
Oh,
so
wow.
Left Right Hook, they box. Incredible program. And Donna is – amazing, Donna Lyon, she's the founder. And Lighthouse Foundation is all about, you know, kids, young people who are facing homelessness. Yeah, most recently I've started working with Fitted for Work, which is
brilliant.
Yeah, incredible. So that's very much it's for me it's about women. I mean, I grew up barely any men in my life, like my grandfather, who I wasn't particularly close to, and that was it.
So we didn't ask about you. We know when your grandfather died was the day of your interview.
Yeah.
But siblings?
So I have an older sister, younger sister, my mum, my nana and my grandmother was sort of my core family.
After
right?
your dad died.
Yeah.
So it was just, yeah. Wow.
So women are just, it's kind of what I'm drawn to as far as the needle that I want to shift in the world, I guess, and particularly disadvantaged, you know, women or young people because – yeah, I just feel kind of aligned. Not that I had that experience, but aligned with the sort of challenges, I suppose, that they, in far more extreme circumstances, face.
And what about how you show up as a mum to a daughter? How does some of what we're talking about now play out for you in parenthood?
Well, largely she's, she's my best friend, so that's nice.
How old is she?
She's almost 15. And we're very close. She's, my best friend. What I wanted for her was for her not to be the person that I was, which was to be always scared, really. I wanted her to just be aware of her sense of self and her true voice, you know, and that she was enough, basically. That's always been my purpose from the moment she was born. And she's had a lot of health issues over her time, her 14 years, almost 15, probably 15 by the time you release this. But in that time, like I've kind of really, from the day she was like 4 days old, she's had issues. And so I've always really felt like my job is to just be present with her and not worry about doctors and the manila folder of her file just getting fatter and fatter and all these things. Like all I could do was be present with her and accept her entirely as she was and allow her to really love herself and see that she was enough. So that's kind of what I wish for every woman. That's what I wish for Broad Radio. That's what I wish for people who listen to Broad Radio and for anybody that reads my column or anyone that interacts with me personally. Every single thing is about just allowing people to understand that, you know, you're the sum total of the things that people have said to you and the things that you've read and the things that are deeply wounding even the ones that feel trivial to you, they're deeply wounding and you carry them with you, but that's not who you actually are. And what you are, you know, what you were born as is this incredibly brilliant, beautiful person. And I just want you to live your biggest self and your bravest self. I want that for her and I want that for everyone.
How do you stay present? I mean, as a parent, we know that's best practice, but in reality, I know I don't do that well. I know, you know, I can talk about mindfulness, I can talk about parenting as an expert with my psychology hat on, but when you're drawn or pulled or engaged even in so many things that ignite and excite, which is what I feel like there's so many fabulous things to do in the world with work, with friends, with making an impact and connection, and I mean the list goes on and on and on. It's hard to be present as a parent all the time.
Of course. No one can be, surely. No. Really?
No, I agree. I agree. But you said, maybe you said I tried to be present with her.
Oh, I mean, that's just always my, I guess you asked me how I showed up as a mother. I think that's my goal. That's my purpose with her. But I really trained myself. I mean, she was really sick, and there were times when people said horrible things about her because prognosis was bad, and, you know, and I guess I just I am someone who I meditate every day and mindfulness is my daily practice, but it wasn't until I had her that I really understood what the power of that could be, which was that right here, right now, she is perfect. I don't care what anyone says. So I guess I trained myself to do that. My house is filthy. Like, I want you to know. It's not like I will just not do housework in favor of spending time with her. I will, you know, that's kind of the choices I make are all about. And it's easier too because she has no siblings, right? If I had three screaming kids, it's a very different relationship and it's a very different dynamic. I've literally just got her and me, my husband, whatever animals are alive at the time that come and go, you know. That's it, right? It's pretty easy to kind of make that choice to be present in that way. Of course, I'm not like that all the time. Of course, I fail at that.
You've said you just hope for her that she knows she's enough. And yeah, I think women and girls for so long and even still are told they're not enough if they're not telling themselves, society's telling them that. And so you try to do everything and be everything and it's still not enough, or you sit with yourself at the end of the day and, you know, your tank's empty and everyone else is full. Do you feel like you're enough?
I do now, but I didn't for a very long time. And that was drummed into me. Like I was raised in a Christian family. So, you know, basically if you're not Christ-like, you're not enough, right?
Well, he came to a bitter end, so.
Was he enough? Did Jesus feel like he was enough? But yeah, like that's how I was raised. I was deeply flawed, and all of my natural instincts as a teenage girl, you know, to go and do the things that adolescents do, that made me not enough. Any career I might have chosen, probably not enough. And yeah, then layer all the societal understandings of you as a woman and all that shit. I mean, you know, no different to anyone else. But yeah, no, it was really only until, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago that I really started to feel like I don't care anymore. But I think that comes with turning 50. That really helped. I just don't give a shit anymore.
And a certain wild abandon that comes. What is it with that wild and precious life? How will you go out and take it and stop asking for permission?
Yeah.
But why do we need to turn 50 before we give less fucks?
I know, that's exactly my, that's true.
I mean, is it something to do with, you know, the nexus of if you've had kids, not always, but often then, you know, that responsibility is easing up a bit by the time you hit 50. Your kids might be a bit older or they're leaving home. Is it that society renders you somewhat redundant, at least to look at a certain age where you do become invisible? And so it's almost as this radical reclamation of self at a point and go, well, if no one else is going to do it, I'm going to fucking, you know, go out there and live my life. So I wonder if there's something around those cycles of motherhood, of you know.
I think you for me, I stopped caring about the gays.
That's G-A-Z-E.
Yeah.
Because it's not G-A-Y-S.
Yeah. I love the gays, but...
gays.
Yeah. And I don't mean just male gays. I mean, you know, female gays as well. Like, we've all spent a whole lot of time worrying about what women think of us.
But and you're still in public, though. Like, you're still under the public gaze. So you haven't shifted the lookers.
No, but it becomes... I mean, I've never really given a shit about the industry as such and the notion that I'm high profile. That has always felt strange to me, to the point where at times I've forgotten it, and to my detriment, because I've been, you know, perhaps...
running down the street naked.
Well, yeah.
Turning up on the red carpet in your pyjamas.
Yeah, exactly, yes. I don't know, whatever. At times it's just not been on my mind.
Lying in the street in Canberra drunk.
Yeah. Oh my God, he needs to know about the gays. that's just not been on my mind. But my career and my job has always been about relationship with an audience and being a writer and a content creator and hopefully shifting how people feel in their day. That's really all that's mattered. And it just happened to have. Fortunately for me, a platform that had a big audience. That's sort of how I saw it. But as I've got older, and that's why TV has never felt my true love. Radio has always been my favourite thing. But as I get older, I'm even less interested in the public side of what I do. And it's a challenge for me. I'm like, I'm ready to not have to... I mean, I almost never wear makeup as it is. I do laugh when people have, you know, you see on, not that they do it so much anymore maybe, but, you know, stars without makeup. I'm like, fuck
big
me.
Deal.
They'd be lucky to find a photo of me in makeup, really. So I just kind of feel less and less like I want to be in the public eye, and so that side of my job doesn't appeal that. It's harder for me now. I hate feeling like anyone's looking at me, to be honest.
You've gone into this broad radio venture with your husband.
Mm.
What is that like, to work on such a scale with such a dream and so much desire for impact and probably pressure as well to succeed with your partner?
Oh, what a beautiful thing. He's so brilliant and... like, he's a clever, clever person, very creative, and we've collaborated always, not so much in not such an official way, but we're always at every step of whatever each of us are doing, we'll always talk things through and what about this and let's write some ideas while we're cooking dinner or whatever. We're cooking dinner. It makes it sound like we, you know, like a Coca-Cola commercial, just all mucking in together.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen.
It does.
That
Coke
Zero. Yeah, that's it. Oh my God. So it doesn't happen.
More like coconut water, I'm thinking.
We don't cook dinner together like a couple. Oh, it's so funny.
I can already hear the music playing.
You just shattered my dream.
I'm so sorry.
The story
present with your daughter.
We've got Chopin on in the background. Or, you know.
Are you in a negligee?
Absolutely, yes. So it was just a natural fit for us to then do this together. So because we've always been collaborators, and he is very much a driver when I have decided in that moment this is just not possible and I can't do this, he'll be like, yeah, you can. So just keep going.
I bet you carry him sometimes when he falls down to
Absolutely,
it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe he carries me more often. I don't know, but he's an eternally positive person.
On caring people,
yes.
Just I'm still trying to turn around in my head this whole why do women, some women at 50, have this sudden sort of rushing at the gates to bust out of whatever it is they've been doing, and is some of that about the caring they've been doing for a lot of other people about this, well, I'm going to say burden of care, but burden's a loaded word, literally. but I do wonder about that, whether you're sort of emancipating yourself from the role that has been subjugating your own self to care for children, husbands, family.
Yeah, I mean, we walked this week, Mads, and you used the phrase being in service to others. I heard that really loudly and saying, I don't want, I hope it's okay to bring up our walks on air, I think it is, I don't want to be in service all the time to others. I want to be in service to myself.
Yeah, yeah. And what I mean by that is there is a notion I take seriously as a mother, as a sibling, as a wife, as a friend, to serve others. I mean, I think that's a noble and thing to do, is to serve others. But if you're in service, I suppose there's a negative correlation around that, where at times I've felt I've over-indexed towards serving others and not myself, and that's to everybody's detriment, because you end up resentful sitting in a bath.
You do, and also being, you know, saying irrationally nasty things that you don't actually mean, and then you go away in a shame spiral.
And being resentfully in service is not being in service.
Well, I think it's just, if you're not filling your own cup, or whatever other thousand cliches you want to use, then, you know, this, there can be a point, and I'll speak from my own experience. It's the only one I have, in that, you know, I've completely emptied my own cup, or you've put it, you know, filled the plate for everybody and you didn't leave a slice for yourself. And I think it's that notion. And I think as mothers often, or as partners, that can be common, this servitude that women can default back to please everybody else, make everything okay, continue to nurture, but not oneself.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a thing that, I know that you do, you're on the speaker circuit, you probably both are, and you so often get asked to talk about work-life balance, which I fucking hate.
No, it's just bullshit.
It's a bullshit phrase, right? And it's like, now add a layer to all the things you do to have work-life balance as well. It's like, okay, there's more guilt that I'm somehow not ticking that box now. I didn't get to Pilates and I haven't meditated today, and what am I supposed to, like, it's ridiculous, right? The added expectation that women only, no one asks a man about work-life balance. But one thing I do say in the context of that, for some reason, what people want you to talk about is exactly that you have to make the choice. And I do talk about being in service of, as far as I'm in service of my purpose and the universe, right? So I am in service of that, which is what Broad Radio is. It's my purpose. But I'm in service to do that. I have to be in service of myself and to really care for myself. And you just have to just flat out say no.
Mm.
Just say no and prioritize this time. Put it in the diary. Do not compromise. That is happening because you have to do it.
And don't apologize for it. And I do get asked to speak about work-life balance a lot, and I always say it's not even a phrase that's meaningful to me, because it infers there's some equal balance between work and life, which there isn't. It's kind of an odd turn of phrase in itself. And I'll often say, but maybe if we can talk about work-life boundaries, which is really just talking about boundaries, which is really talking about choices, which is what you've just said.
Which is about saying no.
Yeah.
Which is about saying no, which is about having priorities and knowing which are your dearest values, and those are the choices you'll respond to.
Exactly. But I always feel too, I don't know if you get this sense when I'm like, when I'm saying that, I always feel like some of the women in the room are thinking, well, that's not a magic trick that I was after. I wanted like a cure or some kind of strategy that was going to change my life, and I can't possibly do that. And I want to just say, but the only way you will do it is by making the choice.
And following through with the action.
And no one can make that choice but you.
Yeah, choice and behaviour. And I can relate as a psychologist when people say all the time, I don't do a lot of clinical work anymore, but people often say, I don't want to, or I've heard over the years, I don't want to talk about my childhood and I don't want to go backwards. You know, I don't want to deep dive the hard stuff. I just want some practical solutions. That's a really common catch cry to people in therapy, for people in therapy. And again, my belief is that we have a sense of agency and wisdom and knowing within ourselves. Sometimes we drop the tools in that kit and we lose our way. Being in therapy, being with a friend, exploring self allows you to get more in touch with what your needs are and those unmet needs that you've either lost track of. But the only person who's going to really make the decision, make the change, do the work is you. So that if there was a simple magic bullet panacea, like your peeps are asking for you, Joe, we'd all know about it.
Yeah. Do you think too, though, and I'm interested to know, because my theory is we don't say no because we don't feel like we're worthy enough to center our own needs, right? That's what I feel like. And the journey towards being able to set boundaries is around somehow what we've just been talking about, of actually understanding your worth and that you are enough.
I think we often don't say no because we're fearful of judgment and rejection. If you say no and then they say, well, we won't ask Jo again. Well, Jo's a bit of an asshole, isn't she? She said no to us. We don't want that. So I don't know if it's not being good enough. It's being attached and connected and having acceptance at a deeper level, I think, that drives us to people please and say yes, which is obviously the opposite of creating a boundary.
And self-worth, actually recognising you are worthy, you are enough. Which takes phrase, isn't it?
You are enough. I mean, it's kind of lost some of its punch because we hear that so much, but it's real.
I feel the same way about the word empowerment, which really is sad for me because I've not been able to find an alternative word to empowerment that means empowerment, but it's used so much now that I'm just like, I want to rewind 10 years when it was a really magical
word. Yeah, I know, it's become very Instagrammable now. I think Maya Angelou and others have had better words, like, you know, I like the word rising, you know, and that can mean different things for different people, but someone coming into their power, which is empowerment, but from their own selves, not sort of someone reaching across some chasm to sort of say, come over here where we've got this great nectar you can have to make you feel empowered and read my book or listen to my fucking talk or whatever. Mm. Like, it has got to come from a rising... I sound so cynical. I probably
need... You listen to my fucking talk.
But like, as I spurt into a microphone, but I do think it has got to... It's this sense of the rising and the power in oneself and it's reclaiming that at a certain point as women. Mm. Anyway...
Yeah.
We like to end these conversations. We could keep talking all day. You're a very good talker. We like to end these conversations by asking all our guests the same question, and that is where you look at life and all its complexity and your own journey. When you look around, who do you think is doing human well?
Who is doing human well? It's so funny. That's a funny question because you go, they might disagree with me.
But you were going to give funny. No fucks about what other people thought.
I don't know. But if I name someone, who knows? You never know what people are going through is what I'm saying, I guess. So I would say my dear friend and podcast co-host, Mimi Quire, I think is doing human beautifully well. She inspires me a great deal to... see the abundance and beauty in the world, which is something that I met her in this very house, actually. And, you know, it was sort of a practice of mine before I met her, but she really lives it. So that's kind of lovely to be around. I think she does human well.
Yeah. Well, I texted her today to say that we were chatting to you today and she said, I can't wait to listen. She's going to hear that. And a shout out to you, Mimi, because it's what a beautiful thing.
Read her book.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Her book's incredible.
House of Choir.
Yeah. I think she'll agree with you and I think many others will too. Thank you, Jo, for joining us on Human Cogs today.
Thank you.
Thank you for everything you're building for the broads out there at Broad Radio. We can't wait for that to hit the airwaves.
Thanks.
Vulva Radio.
I did go for that, but maybe
Triple
that's already been used.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Human Cogs. We hope that this conversation has led you to think a little bit differently about yourself and those around you.
And thank you for all the amazing feedback that we get about these conversations. If you do like Human Cogs and what we're doing, we would love you to hit subscribe and please leave us a star rating. What that means is we can keep bringing you more stories from extraordinary ordinaries to help us all
do human well.